Rock and roll, I got Jay Tenenbaum on the Capital Racer Show. What's up, brother?
Hey, Ruben. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, brother. You're here local in town, dude. You're in Scottsdale, right? Where are you at?
Actually, I'm in the East Valley. Attend the East Valley. I've got two 14-year-old twin daughters who have to go to high school where they have a good dance program and they're tethered to their ballet, which is like 5-6 days a week. So,
wow.
Yes, I'm the East Valley guy.
How old are they?
14.
Wow.
Just starting high school.
Are you planting some seeds in their head about getting into passive investing, real estate investing, hedge fund creation, stuff like that?
One of my daughters asks me every once in a while, like she's over at a friend's house and she's like, Dad, what do you do? My friend's dad's asking.
That's fantastic. Okay, cool, man. For the audience that doesn't know Jay Tenenbaum, tell us a little bit about your background, my friend.
So born and raised in Denver, Colorado. Parents were in the restaurant business. My mom owned a catering service for 50 plus years. My father owned restaurants. Nobody at the dining room table, dinner table, nobody ever said, hey, you grew up to be entrepreneurs. It just kind of fell that way. I thought I'd stay in the restaurant business, born and raised in Denver. One night I'm having dinner with my father and he's like, get out of this business, we're in a profession. So
what?
I went to law school. Wow. Got accepted to law school in California, moved, stayed, met my wife at a first job, been married almost 32 years, and did debt collection, had our own law for about 18 years, 45 hangnail employees did me in there, and started investing in real estate about 2013 in distressed mortgage notes. I mean, I like to say I've been in debt all my life, just not personally.
Fantastic. All right, man. So I got to bring this up, man, because I think as entrepreneurs, we want people to root for us, particularly family members. I got to dive into this a little bit deeper because I remember this is a little bit confusing, right? So I was in the MBA program and my mom's just like, why are you studying this? Like, get out of this. You're driving yourself into debt and being an entrepreneur is very risky. It's hard to. I come from a conservative Mexican Hispanic family and they're not into that. They like preservation of wealth if they have any wealth. But you talked about how some people in your family may not have been, I would say that they're rooting for you, but they may not know the same things or have the same sentiment about entrepreneurship as the person that they're raising. So tell me, what was that like trying to convince your friends and your family that this is a good path for you? Did you get a lot of people rooting for you or not?
That's an interesting question. From the family side, nobody really, my siblings, as far as the real estate investing piece, nobody really understands what I do. It's like, what's a distressed mortgage? They own their own houses, but they really don't know what distressed mortgages are. But then what's ironic is that all of us, I've got two brothers and a sister, we all are entrepreneurs. But again, at the dining room table, there was never any discussion about you're all going to be trained to be entrepreneurs. My brother is a car dealer. He sold 19 of his dealerships about 2 years ago. He still owns about 9 of them. My brother took over my mom's catering service and owns a wholesale spice company. And my sister was, I guess, maybe the less of the entrepreneur. She was the producer of a nonprofit radio show in San Francisco for many years.
All right. So wealth consciousness is a topic. I took this wealth consciousness course back in 2011. And they're like, hey, you have to show your record in terms of net worth and what assets and liabilities you have to this entire group of like 25 people or something like that. And people are very uncomfortable about talking about money with people that they don't know. Particularly, it's interesting that even within families, like people don't know what people's finances are and people don't talk about at the dinner table. Hey, you know, this is how much we have to do to pay the mortgage this month. And this is what you should be doing with your savings. And this is what you should be doing to create a retirement. Was this a topic of conversation at any of your dinners as you were growing up or?
Not at all. My mom catering service grew from the basement of our house in Denver to a commercial building that they own and a fleet of trucks and a multi-million dollar business. But I don't think any of our siblings ever really knew what put me through law school. We all had a decent upbringing and all that, but there was never any conversation about, you know, our net worth is whatever. Now, when my father died and my mom started, her health is getting worse, my siblings more or less stepped in and realized, at least what my mom had been managing was kind of a shit show. A little bit. Mm-hmm. So that was partial of having them uncovering what was going on. Nothing major. It's just kind of just taking the reins from my mom, who's got dementia now, unfortunately, and just making it all happen. So where that's at. I wouldn't say that I'm the black sheep of the family. I'm the independent one. I'm the one like less, not as engaged with everybody else. Not there's any issues. There's not. It's just on a day-to-day basis.
I can relate.
I go about my business. My family, my immediate family is important to me. My family in general is important to me, but I'm just not as connected with everybody, not as an angst or tears of endearment. We're just not. We all do our different things. I was the oldest And I was out of the house first. So it kind of just, I'm not that much older than the rest of my siblings. It's just the perception of, hey, you were the first one to fly the coop first. So we know you, we didn't deal with you at home. So we don't deal with you now.
So was there any talk about what kind of car you should be driving? So I want to kind of dive into this wealth consciousness concept a little bit, because they said in this particular course, hey, you don't need to drive a Mercedes-Benz or something to impress the Joneses. And you certainly shouldn't buy a brand new car if you don't need to, if your liabilities are being paid out of pocket. But if you can find a business or something that provides passive income that can pay for your car, that makes sense. That's not the typical conversation that happens within families. Here's something that I heard that was kind of interesting, that even if you're driving an old car, as soon as that old car starts affecting your self-worth, it's time to upgrade. What are your thoughts?
A good question. So my brother car dealer has got the Cadillac, the caviar money and the caviar taste. That's fine. My little brother doesn't have that kind of taste, nor does my sister, and nor do I for that matter. What I learned from my father years ago was don't ever get attached to those material things. To him, your house was four walls and a roof. His car, four wheels and a motor. I mean, it was not a big deal. Now, my brother, the car dealer, was easy because about every 3 years, we'd lease a car would come due. He'd say, you know, Hyundai's having a better special than Lexus right now, and just put me in a different car. And it was always four wheels and a house and a car payment for forever. I like certain cars better than others, but I wasn't attached to them. Through the end of 3 years, I was fine to give it up. You know, I just traded in a few months back a Hyundai Sonata Hybrid. It had 105,000 miles on it. I didn't care. When it started breaking down and the hybrid motor started costing, fighting with Hyundai for the $8,000 replacement battery, then it was time to get rid of it. But other than that, I didn't care.
Cool. Interesting. All right, man, let's dive into your business. So you're talking about distressed notes. So let's talk about this a little bit in higher detail. I used to be a mortgage guy, so I know a little bit about lending and the mortgage-backed securities and a couple other things. What is a distressed note? How do you syndicate it? How do your investors make money? These are kind of some of the topics that I want to play with. We'll break them down one at a time. So what is your business exactly?
So we buy distressed mortgage notes from hedge fund and bank relations we have all over the country. So basically what happens is you, Joe homeowner, stop paying on your mortgage, like Bank of America, whatever. They sold it to Wall Street. Wall Street packaged it up and sold it for $1.95 as a security, as a commodity somewhere else. And it gets down to certain other lower level hedge funds. We pride ourselves, though, is we're the hedge fund that will take it and actually work through it. Everybody else is just buying and selling it, buying and selling it. Nobody's moving. Mm-hmm. And some of the stories you hear about how nobody's made a mortgage payment for 10 years. Yeah, your mortgage could have been bought and sold so often, nobody foreclosed on you. We would be the ones that would probably foreclose on you because now we're buying it for our own portfolio and we're going to work through it. That's how we do it.
So somebody is late on their payments, getting close to foreclosure. Their note may or may not be traded from securities company to securities company or hedge fund or bank to bank or whatever. So you purchase these with the concept of you're buying them at a discount, correct?
Correct. Absolutely.
And the reason that they're selling these to you at a discount is because they're late on their payments, something like that, correct? They're distressed.
Yeah. I mean, the pools that we see are just a pool of non-performing loans. They're probably delinquent. Oftentimes much more than 5 minutes. They've been lingering, these loans have been lingering around for a while. And so, yeah, the more delinquent they are, the more, depending on what state it is, the more discount we can get. And our hedge fund relationships are selling because, well, you know, something, it's not necessarily getting rid of the dogs in their portfolio. It's just really, they have an active sale process where they'll just recapitalize and buy more other notes from some other, from Morgan Stanley or whatever, or Goldman Sachs. So it's recapitalizing is why we get the opportunities. And like I said, they're not as aggressive as us as far as working through it. So we're creating the value add. We'll take it to foreclosure. We've bought plenty of loans that are already in foreclosure. We've got plenty of loans that haven't, foreclosure hasn't even started yet. It all depends on which hedge fund we're getting it from and how active they are in moving through and moving forward.
Break down this process a little bit. You talked about value add to a distressed note. Do you work with the buyers to get them back on track? What do you do to increase the value of these notes so that you can retrade them or make them worth more?
Good question. Yes. First piece of value added that's occupied is absolutely, we will work with the borrowers and keep them in their homes and create the loan modification cash flow. Absolutely. And then retrade the performing loans on the secondary market. That is one spot. The other piece of value add is if I buy it and foreclosure hasn't started it, well, I've created the value add. Let's say I decide to sell it 2 months before foreclosure sale. I was probably 6 months farther along the foreclosure trail than when I bought it. Right? So there's value to the investor if I was going to sell it that quick to foreclosure. And we simply, we pick up the same stuff. we picked up assets that have been that close foreclosure sale as well. Other value add is if I don't get paid off at auction, which happens a lot of the time in this market, in this current market, in this market, we'll take it back and it's now an REO. Now I may wholesale it, someone else. Well, I guess resell it. I already own it, so I'm not wholesaling it. Or fix and flip it ourselves.
So one of my mentors really loved seller financing, and he would buy a bunch of different kinds of real estate assets, and then he would seller finance them to people with the understanding that most people only stay in a mortgage for, even if it's a seller finance mortgage, on average for like 7 years or something like that. And if they neglected or failed to perform on their notes, he would take the property back. And he thought that this was a good thing because now he could just seller finance it again and turn himself into a bank again. From your perspective, when you get a note that you have to foreclose on, is it a good thing, bad thing? What's your perspective?
For the most part, we foreclose on those who can't get out of their own way. I mean, if you're a borrower that's living in your home and you just can't get out of your own way, you're going to foreclose on. We also have bought a lot of reverse mortgages where the borrower is already deceased. You're not going to do a loan on with a dead guy. It's not. Reciprocally, I'm a champion of seller financing. We've got a good structure in place to be Dodd-Frank compliant. I'm a champion of doing, if I've got a property that I want to move, right, that I own, I took note back at auction, I will, on balance, seller finance before I'll do a lease option or rent all day long. I don't want to be the damn landlord.
So seller finance to a new buyer or?
Yeah. Or we may take over a property where there's the foreclosed borrower had a tenant in there. I'll seller finance the tenant. I've done that many times.
Fascinating.
Great home ownership.
I want to hear about Dodd-Frank because I know that this is a law that wasn't around back during the crash, the real estate crash, from my understanding. What is Dodd-Frank? What does it mean in terms of how many notes that you could possess?
Dodd-Frank has nothing to do with the notes that you want to possess necessarily. What Dodd-Frank was originated to accomplish is that the borrowers can afford their homes. Dodd-Frank, what I mean by Dodd-Frank compliant is that there's an analysis done by a mortgage loan originator, licensed mortgage loan originator, that certifies that the borrower can in fact afford the home. What I mean by that is they examine their income against the Fannie Mae guidelines debt ratios. For example, they do analysis of your income percentage to your mortgage, your income percentage to your total debt. So I think Fannie Mae is around 20, late, low, high 20s, low 30s, your percentage to your mortgage, and in the mid, low 40s, your percentage, the high 30s, low 40s, your percentage to your total debt of first year income. If that's out of whack, like your number, your percentage is too high, you just extend the loan, lower the monthly payment, extend the loan. I've created 40-year loans if I had to.
Okay, so I'm curious about this because I was hearing, and maybe I'm either confusing the law or maybe not dissecting this law to a great extent, and it's not my industry, so that makes sense. But I heard that like if you're buying and selling notes and it's kind of like a car dealer, right? You're talking about your brother. Once you buy and sell 5 cars within a year, now you have to be licensed. Is there something like that when you're...
There are certain states that require, they have certain, Georgia's one of them. If you own three loans, you have to be a licensed broker. Yes, there are a few states with restrictions on those. There's some states that you have to be a licensed debt collector. Some of the stuff like, there's some regulatory licensing issues with regards to that. Two things. That doesn't affect your ability to sell or finance, although there is, and under Dodd-Frank, you can only do so many, if you're not a mortgage loan originator yourself, you can only do so many seller finances. But here's the thing. You kind of easily get around that by, for example, if I'm buying a portfolio of certain loans in a specific syndication, Scottsdale REI syndication number 29. Okay, if I hit the max on my seller finance originated loans in that portfolio, my next portfolio starts the clock all over again because it's just the end. That is a different entity. But we don't do enough to get on the radar. We've done a lot of seller finance, but it's a handful. A lot because we're good at it. It's not our bread and butter. We originate maybe over our entire portfolio, maybe originate maybe two or three a year, if that.
Okay. So in single family real estate and even multifamily real estate, there's a lot of mom and pop guys just doing one-off houses, flicks and flips one at a time. And I'm assuming that there's some mom and pop note buyers that just do a couple here and there, but you actually do enough where you can create a syndication. Talk to us about the difference between mom and pop note buyers and sellers versus syndicators in the space.
Sure. So it's really a matter of scale. It's not necessarily mom and pop because you can do a syndication even if you're mom and pop. What the difference is, yeah, is you go from from raising capital, if it's just, okay, if I'm buying one loan, four loans, 12 loans, whatever, and I'm raising capital just with you, you're investing the whole deal, I could do it as a joint venture partnership. We're in agreement between the two of us. And I used to do that for many, many years. And then as we started buying, but I was buying low value assets. You and I could invest in three notes together, cost 50 grand, you know, stuff like that. When we started buying loans that the price tag of the loans were six figures, now you're saying, well, gee, am I limiting my investor pool to only that investor could write a six-figure check? No, I can set up a member-managed LLC, is what we do. And now two or three guys can contribute collectively what it takes to buy that loan or buy that pool.
Okay, so talk to me about how your investors make money, what kind of returns. Well, I'm not sure if you're doing 506 or 506C. Maybe we should go naturally.
We don't go. We're not a fund yet. I mean, we're building that now. Okay. But really, as a member managed LLC, you're not under the security laws. You're not even a security. Why? Because it's a member managed limited partnership, meaning limited liability company, meaning the investors have decision making power and rights and obligation and responsibility.
So let's break down the investors. Are they the same investors in a syndication and a fund? Or JV, or are they different? Do you have limited partners in the syndications versus somebody that brings all the money in a JV? I mean, I think the answer is obvious.
So basically, the way our Series LLC is set up is Scottsdale is the administrative member. We get one vote. My capital partners, whether it's 100% of the capital, or now we have a debt facility, so they're bringing in our syndications now. Our capital partners are bringing in about 20% on average of the total project. And getting about a 20, 25%, 30% return on their equity share in the syndication. With that, they're bringing in about 20% of the capital for 20, 30% equity stake. Usually they're not limited partners, they're the class A investors, and they all have a collective, they get a return based on the pro rata share of their contribution. Not everybody has to come in equal.
Who have you been seeking up to date to partner with you? Are they LPs, are they JVs, are they institutions? Who's giving you the capital to take down these notes?
We happen to be involved in, Sadie and I met in a real estate community that was here local in Phoenix at the time, that's now nationwide. And so basically the other members of our community has been kind of we run the masterminds in the community, including an out-of-state mastermind, showing people how to invest in out-of-state assets, primarily notes. So that's really where we're getting the majority of our investor base from. And then just I've had my own investor base since I've been doing this since 2013.
It's a great business model. But I think it's a business model that a lot of people don't know about. So what are you doing to educate and nurture people? Are you doing that for LPs, or are you just going to people networking one-on-one and explaining to them why it's a good business?
It's a little of both. Somebody may hear me on this podcast and hit me up because they want to learn more about what's going on. And it's really a matter of having that call to say, are we a good fit? What are your goals and objectives? And if it's a good fit. And then basically what my process is real simple. I will send you some examples, some prospectuses of deals we've already funded. So I'm not asking you for a check in the first 5 minutes we meet. We got a date first. And so basically we have a conversation over what our past deals have looked like. And typically the investor's interested. And the magic words are, when you've got another deal, let me know. I always like to tell a story. My business partner, Seti, came from the Wall Street background, right? He's the analytical guy of our machine. So I was having an investor call one day and he said, I want to listen in. I want to learn from your call. And I tell the story that he was severely disappointed. Why, you asked? Well, I'd already had the call with the guy over the past deals. He'd already said, hey, when you have your next deal, let me know. I sent him the next deal. The follow-up call after he reviewed the deal that we're looking for to fill the investment with was the one that said he wanted to listen to. The call lasted less than 3 minutes. He got on the phone. And he said, I reviewed what you sent me. I'm in. Said he expected to have some learning experience, and there wasn't any.
Okay, so tell me about when you're having these conversations with people. Let's just say that, I don't know, let's say that I'm a sophisticated investor. I got two trust funds for my children. One of them is a little conservative, might dabble in some real estate and some other conservative, not like businesses or angel startups or something that's high risk, like oil and gas, or maybe that's not even oil and gas. Maybe I'm just not educated in this space. But then there's another one that's just like, hey, man, I got this capital that I want to diversify into stuff that's not common, at least for my education level. I can invest in multifamily syndications, but I want to get into some other stuff, ATM funds, maybe some note syndications. Why should I invest in a note syndication with you? Tell me about that. What would you say?
Well, it's not what I'm going to say. It's what I'm going to show you. I'm not going to promise you anything. I'm not going to sell you anything. It's like I said, when I send people examples of prior deals and you're looking at the what the investment was, what the returns were, what the outcomes were, you're either hooked or you're not. But part of that, and again, goes back to conversation. The first conversation is, like I said, I'll have a conversation with you and say, what are you investing in now? What kind of returns are you getting now? Mm-hmm. If you're a guy who's investing in the stock market successfully, making 45% returns daily, we're not a good fit because I'm not going to produce those type of results on an ongoing basis. And I can at times, especially the low value stuff, I can produce those kind of returns, but that's not what I expect to return. When anybody asks you, what kind of return can I expect? You just show them. You're Missouri, the show me state. You just show them what you've done. It's your track record. You mentioned it before, what your track record looks like. It's all about your credibility is born in your track record. It's not born in my personality or what I'm going to tell you. In fact, the less I speak, the better we are on because you're making a decision based on what I'm showing you, not what I'm telling you.
Okay. And then what is the typical size of the syndications that you've been doing in the past?
Oh, we've done anything. We've been buying, like 2 weeks ago, we bought 40 loans and we spent $2.5 million. Now we had about 80% of that was debt. So about $350,000 was the equity piece of it.
So I love talking about people that are starting their own fund or moving from one-off syndications into the fund space. I believe this is where you find yourself today. Tell me about why you want to start a fund. What do you envision for doing that?
So once upon a time, I had blonde hair. What I'm saying is with capital raising, when you're trying to, even with the syndication, while you can pool, you can use multiple investors with different check sizes, it's a grind. Granted, I've got a process nailed down. It's a grind to be able to coordinate, okay, I'm closing the end of the month on this syndication and I got to raise the capital. In a fund, you're like basically just, you know, like the ocean, just ongoing raising it and you've got the money on hand whenever you need to deploy it. Because we're purchasing monthly. We're very active purchasers in the stress. We bought over almost 100 loans since this April. So the fund becomes the next natural progression just to say, hey, we've got the money on hand. We're building it up because it's a challenge. The necessity to have to raise, you know, $350,000, $500,000, $300,000, $200,000 on a monthly basis. It's just, it's a process. It's a program. Yeah. And it works. Finish your diligence and you put your deal together and you put the prospectus together and you blast it out to your database and then you start building calls and get it filled. Yeah, it takes a few days to get that done. Knock on wood. I get it done very quickly. But still, I'm burnt out doing that. Pulling your hair out, just coordinating it all, sometimes just drives you nuts.
So a lot of times when people come to me and say, hey, I'm interested in starting a fund, I talk to them about this concept that if they go to a lawyer can set up their fund, no problem. But the lawyer is not going to give them any business advice. And what I end up doing is referring them to a couple of different business fund architecture consultants. One person that comes to mind is Joel Block, who I recently had you speak with. Can you tell me about what that conversation was and why you should talk to somebody like that instead of a lawyer first?
We had a wonderful conversation with Joel. Thank you very much for the referral. What was enlightening with Joel was two things resonated with me. And that was, rather than the lawyer who's constrained to be able to give you, I mean, the lawyer will put the documentation together. The lawyer will give you some guidance as to what terms you should use as far as what you're giving your investors or what you're putting together for management fees, et cetera. But they're somewhat constrained because they're still giving you legal advice, and that's difficult. So with Joel, it was a matter of, yes, I've done this as a practitioner. I've done this a gazillion times. I can guide you into what works. In addition to where the lawyer that says, sure, it's good, your PPM is going to be, your private placement memorandum is going to be 50 grand. Joel's fee structure is kind of, it's a plan and a process. And even some of the money that you pay him is on the back end of the raise. So it's very economical. You know, he's charging, he's not cheap, but it's very economical the way the plan is structured. The third piece that resonated with me is he's very, very knowledgeable in what he was doing. I want a guy who will tell me my baby is ugly. If I come to him and say, I want to start a fund and out of touch with reality, I want somebody to tell me, no, that's not going to work. I got the impression that he really was really capable of guiding us to say, what I would suggest you do, how you do it. I mean, like even in the capital raising side that we're talking about, where you get to know your potential investor, he really spent the time on that call to get to know us. There was a lot of back and forth questions on both sides. We weren't selling each other. We weren't interviewing each other. It was just really a very nice conversation. He was very, very impressive and very, very likable and very, very interested in working with him. Absolutely. I've talked to a few other guys like that. Nobody's come to that forefront, that caliber.
Yeah, he's super high caliber. And I do consider him a mentor. He's amazing. All right, so tell me about the future of Scottsdale REI. Are you going to continue to work with the same people? How big do you want to scale this thing? Are you going to be moving into any new asset classes? You're going to be dialed into the specific niche that you're in. Tell me more about the future for J. Tenenbaum.
So the future of Scottsdale, everything's an evolution. We all think it's an evolution from buying, low value shithole assets in rural America for spending $5,000-$10,000 on a note to spending six figures on a note is an evolution. Going from JV partnerships to syndications is an evolution. We've done like 29 syndications since December 2020. We've outgrown that because of the opportunities that have come our way. We're getting larger seats at the table of different selling relationships. Successfully, we've been on two HUD auctions, reverse mortgage auctions this year. And we had a conference call today with Freddie Mac. We're now on their approved list. But the conversation with Freddie Mac went like this. When we got offering, what are you guys capable of spending? And on the HUD auction, we bid $5 million. Now, granted, $5 million was huge from where it was maybe 3 years ago. It was probably like $50,000. No, I'm just kidding. A little more than that. Now we're like in the bidding of spending $5 million. And in the Freddie world, gee, that's still a drop in the bucket. So where we need to go to take advantage of the opportunities, the seats at the table that we're getting, I envision us in the next couple of years probably to be a $50 million plus fund. Yes. The opportunity assets, even the single family 1-4 units, which our bread and butter is by distressed mortgages, very, very, very plentiful now. And we haven't even seen what's going to happen in the future, not from the interest rates, whatever, but even before that debacle, you had the moratoriums ending and all that. There is a prediction that you're going to get that wave of loans hitting the market probably the next year anyway. And now you've got the second piece behind it with what interest rates are going to do and it's going to impact anybody's equity and all that. So when I got in this business in 2013, I asked the proverbial question, how long is this gravy train going to last? I was told 3 to 5 years. That was 9 years ago.
Fun. Very cool. Yeah, man. You got to adapt, pivot, and evolve for sure in real estate, regardless of what level you're at or what niche you're specializing in, whether it's single family houses or small multis or big multis or industrial, triple net lease, notes, oil and gas. You got to be constantly on the ball and changing and adapting. So I definitely can relate with that. Tell me, you have a podcast, correct?
Correct. The Real Estate Mastermind. Yes.
So tell me about it.
We've been doing it since around the pandemic. The pandemic shut everything down. We had a rental portfolio at the time. We really hadn't even gone back into notes. And we were toying with the idea. And with all the time on our hands, we just launched it. Just like almost overnight, just boom, did it. So we do it the first and third Tuesday of every month. And we just invite other real estate related professionals to interview. We have a conversation for about an hour. It's not a conversation about who we are, what we do, and monetizing it that way. It's just really a matter of we've had people all walks of life. Other note buyers, yes. Multifamily guys, real estate syndication attorneys.
Nice.
IRA companies, just anybody for all walks of anything real estate. And Tyler, my executive producer, Tyler Wennett, does a fantastic job. All I got to do is just shut up and be present on the first and third Tuesday at 3 o'clock, www.remastermind.live. And the guest is there and it's all booked up. It's all handled.
That's fantastic. Tyler's a great guy.
Yes, he is.
All right. So tell me about who have been your favorite interviews? What have you gained personally and professionally from having a podcast?
Professionally, we haven't monetized it, as far or even started. Like I said, it's more about the guests we have on the show versus ourselves. And other podcasts are all about them, and you create a following and all that, and you monetize it however you so choose. We're just doing it for fun, basically. It's establishing our credibility. I'm sure there's investors who follow us that are being guests on our show, but we do it on Zoom. We do it live. Our guests, our followers, can actually interact with the guests and ask them questions. So that we think that's kind of a unique situation. One of our favorite podcast guests, we've had some really cool people. I guess part of it is that we've done 50, 60 episodes in 2.5 years, 3 years. I can tell you more of the guests that weren't so good, more than I can tell you the guests that were good. Part of it, I think, is the guests that we've had in areas that we knew nothing about and just being enlightened ourselves as to the time we spent with them. Yeah, that was probably the most entertaining, that way. You have no idea, you know nothing about their field, and they just knock your socks off. So yeah, check out our downloads and we figure out what podcast guests you guys like. Because everybody's different, right?
All right, cool. One last question before we jump into the lightning round. What have you learned about capital raising since your beginning days up till now, and what have you changed along the way?
Good question. I think what I've learned by accident, I learned how to capital raise by accident. I was a debt collection attorney. I had no idea how to raise capital. No, I had no necessity to raise capital back then. I think that by accident, my process is similar to a debt collection trial. What I mean by that is if I'm doing a debt collection trial, I've got a witness on the stand, okay, but all I'm doing is showing them documents. Hey, is this, you know, did you enter a contract with Joe Debtor? Yes. Did, you know, here's what the amount was. Did he pay it? No, goodbye. And the documentation speaks for itself. And I've adopted that same approach in capital raising with the prospectus and the track record and things like that. Just put it in front of somebody that's interested and say, hey, you like it or you don't. And I'm not going to talk you into it. I'm not going to talk you out of it, whatever. It's either going to resonate with you or not. So that's one thing I've learned. I've perfected it over the course of time, just going, okay, I've tweaked the model email. Like basically it's going back to the old school, the touch rule. You and I have a conversation, a brief conversation at a networking event. And I'm not the one that's going to compromise your day, your evening and get into your soul, but you've showed some interest. So I send you an email. Here's some past deals we've done with the introductory email, a little bit about us. And then we have another conversation. So I think I perfected that email over the course of time, just tweaked it here and there to you know, keep it relevant. But just kind of just what I've learned is don't deep the process. If it's not broke, don't fix it because it seems to work. That's really what I've learned the most in the capital raising. It's funny, I've raised millions and millions of dollars, but I think I still get excited when that wire shows up in the bank account tomorrow as I did the first time.
All right. That's fantastic. All right, let's jump into the lightning round. My first question to you is, what's the best vacation you've ever taken?
Somewhere on a beach where I just vegged out and relaxed. Caribbean or Hawaii or just anywhere with, when I tune out, I tune out. When I relax, I relax. Like if I'm sitting down, I'm going to watch TV, like at the end of the day, you're sitting down and watch TV, I could be falling asleep in 5 minutes. But when the mind and the brain just stops, I'm out. And when I go on vacation like that, I'm just relaxing. The latest lovely vacations, we've been getting out of the Arizona heat in the summertime. We've been spending a week in July the last 2 years in Newport Beach, renting a house on the beach there.
Oh, I love Newport.
I think the most meaningful vacation is, in fact, we're just going back again this year. My mom always sponsored a trip to Puerto Vallarta, an all-inclusive resort in Puerto Vallarta that we started going on in 2009, interrupted with COVID, and now we're starting back, which is all my brothers and sisters, my siblings, and my niece and nephews, about 25, 30 of us at any given time. It's all-inclusive. My youngest son met a kid from Chicago when they were, 9 years old, and they're still maintaining friendship. He still goes out there every summer to see him as well.
Okay, how about this, man? Favorite childhood memory?
My father, my mom's catering service was just getting started. They were doing a benefit for one of the local hospitals. And because their kitchen facility wasn't mass producing stuff, we pulled the proverbial all-nighter with my father, me, my siblings, some friends that we invited, and did all the cooking and the prep work, all in the proverbial all-nighter with my father. And the bonding, the laughter, I'm still laughing inside of some of the stuff that went on during those every year.
That's cool. How about this? What do you love best about being a dad?
At the end of the day, knowing that my kids turned out right. My oldest is 32. He's a software developer for Fox Sports West in Colorado. And my oldest daughter is 30. She's a flight attendant with Southwest. My middle son has got a good job working for a school locally here. And I know at the end of the day, no matter what I did, right, wrong, or different, it turned out to be just fine.
Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
I wouldn't necessarily say my spiritual philosophy, but the work ethic I learned from my family.
What do you do when you have limiting beliefs? Do you have any hacks for breaking through those beliefs?
That's always been a work in progress for anybody. I think take a deep breath, step back, and let it all crystallize. The knee-jerk reaction will get you in trouble all the time.
All right, so what do you love about skiing? And tell me how excited you are to go helicopter skiing.
So basically, born and raised in Denver, I was a skier since I was a little kid, and I raced in college. And I always say, which is funny, because I grew up in Colorado, I'm familiar with the mountains. I spent most of my life in California with the ocean. I can body surf, I can hang out in the ocean, but I'm more comfortable in the mountains. What I like to say is, with my debt collection experience, I'm really good at asset management. And so the asset management is akin to skiing, and capital raising is akin to the ocean. I'm okay at it, I'm just not as comfortable with it. What I love about skiing is just the fresh air, the open air, and just the enjoyment of the sport. I've never gone helicopter skiing before. I've done out of bounds skiing and some stuff like that. Never done. I'm doing it in December. And it's really a product of, I threw a surprise 60th birthday party for my partner. And one of our mutual friends goes every year, and we're at the party. And he says, you know what? Why don't you come with me? And it's one of the things where I've been pouring so much time and effort in building this business. It's gotten to a point where, you know what? I want to take a step back a little bit here and there and enjoy the fruits of my labor and the enjoyment. And I said, what the hell? Let's just do it.
Oh man, I can't wait to hear about that.
And I haven't skied since 2007, by the way.
Oh, wow. Wow, I did not know that. Okay, cool. How about this? I got two more questions for you. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
Near-death experience, I thought as I was growing up that my destiny was I would die in a car crash. I rolled several cars. I got hit by a drunk driver when I was first started law school. Car rolled completely around the full cycle and almost came to rest on the middle island. And I got to tell you, from the two or three prior rolls, I was calm. I could still see the black kind of, like you're in a roller coaster, you know, or a Ferris wheel. I could still see, just kind of kept calm and waiting for the bus to stop. Because I crushed my hand, but I didn't do anything else more serious. So that was probably the most near death as I would like to come.
Crazy. Okay, last question brought to you by Shanna Amiga, one of our great listeners. She would like to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
That I gave, like a sports athlete, who leaves it all on the field. I left it all on the table. How many borrowers have I helped stay in keeping their homes? That's priceless to me. How many investors have I made them money? That's priceless to me. That's really what it's all about.
Cool answers on the lightning round, my favorite part of the show. Shout out to the Capital Racer Nation. Thanks for tuning in, and please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to Legacy Acquisitions and to our sponsors, Good Egg Investment Syndication Pro, Apartment Educators, The Family Office Club, and PitchDex.com, who now does all of our videos. Check them out at PitchDex.com and get $1,000 off some great programs from our sponsors at thecapitalraisershow.com. So, Jay, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
So, Scottsdale REI is our website, work in progress. J-A-Y at Scottsdale REI is my email. And yes, like the proverbial, I will give you my cell phone and I will answer it, but most people won't take the time to call it. 714-458-6317.
All right. Any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser in the note syndication business?
Just figure out what your, you can't teach style. So develop your style and just go out and just get it done.
Brilliant. All right. Cool, man. This has been a lot of fun, dude. Thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, brother.
My pleasure. Loved it.